Some of these charts don't seem to particularly bear on the problem, but if you study them, you'll see a relationship. Mm-hmm. First off, this covers the shipbuilding versus aircraft wages, which I think is important.
Because I noticed you do mention that at one point there is a shift over to shipbuilding because of the higher wages.
Yeah. Well, that's it graphically.
Right.
Now, these only go up through 43, of course, which tends to be the peak.
Right.
But I couldn't find any later ones. I have a lousy filing system stored in cabinets out there and that down there. And some of it's piled up here, and I have no record where it is. This gives you the female male, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is marvelous because it shows for each plant. And as I suspected, Long Beach was the highest of all of them, quite a bit higher than Santa Monica.
Now, I think in that book I think I said 86 or 87% women on the C-47.
Well, I was going to ask why it was higher on the C-47 than the total plant percentage.
Well, fairly simple. We built so many of them, and it was the DC-3, so it hadn't even been built before. So it was an easy airplane to build by the time what happened. Hap Arnold, because of the invasion, wanted more C-47s than the schedule. We were putting them out at a fairly high rate, and he wanted more. He personally put the demand on Doug Sr. to do this. Well, that meant that we had to, where we were tapering off, we now had to go up. And so we decided to put women in there and put the males on the tougher airplanes to build. It's just a question of you got a simple operation here, and you get pretty practical in those days in particular. So we arrange the people accordingly.
In other words, the jobs on the other planes hadn't been broken down into as small units, it sounds like.
Well, there wasn't much damage you could do to the C-47. It was recoverable in almost any major butch of any kind. Because it was a long-running type of airplane in production before the war and during the war. So it was an easier project to staff with women.
Oh, I see. And so the men work mainly on the A-20Bs then?
A-26 and the C-47 to some extent. I mean the C-74.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I don't know whether, no, maybe it doesn't show there. I thought it would show the models someplace. Well, this one.
Because I had a note to myself, the fact that, oh.
Now, what does it say?
Here's C-47.
Okay.
Backlog.
Now you can see that this is 1943 here, probably, isn't it?
43, right. 41, 43.
Okay, you look at the C-47, and it's got a typical taper-off characteristic, which had to be lifted up for the invasion later. So however, it never peaked out above this point.
Oh, that was the peak.
Yeah, on the C-47.
Which matches about, I know the figures of the employment of women, I think the peak was August 43 for California statewide.
Well, these are the company official charts.
These are very helpful.
And they show the B-24 was built at Tulsa. And the B-17 was Long Beach.
I can have these?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. The B-17 was Long Beach?
Yeah.
And Santa Monica and El Segundo?
Well, to take it right on down here, let's... you got the B-24. Now the A20 would have been at Santa Monica,
mm-hmm.
and the A26 at Long Beach,
mm-hmm.
and this would be at El Segundo.
Okay.
Well, maybe it was one week.
Do you recall what the total employment figures were for Santa Monica and El Segundo? Were they about the same as Long Beach, or were they lower?
Well, we'll see if we got it higher or lower, considerably lower.
This is the proportion, the percentage of women, but it's not. It doesn't indicate the total numbers in the factor in each of the places.
Of women?
This is just the percentage in each factory, but it doesn't have the base figures.
Well, but you have to go to other charts.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is in dollars. And here's... Now here's total employment.
Oh, that's
here.
Very helpful.
But now this is, here's the total way up here,
mm-hmm.
and total company.
Mm-hmm.
This is Santa Monica, El Segundo, Long Beach.
Oh,
I'm going to have another one here, maybe. But now you got, this is on semi-log paper,
mm-hmm.
Logarithmically.
Right.
So. You can, the rates can mm-hmm. change, as you know.
Now, indirect factory would refer to the, would that refer to the feeder plants, is that it?
No, indirect is made up of the type of thing that you can't conveniently charge directly to a contract. Clerical
help.
Oh, I see. Secretaries, clerical help, plant protection.
Oh, this is direct cost and indirect cost, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
I see. These
are the direct people...
Right.
Who are tied into building the product.
Mm-hmm. And this is basically the cost to run
these the... These are the people who support
mm-hmm.
these people
right.
here. They run the tool cribs, and they mm-hmm. run the tow trucks, and they are the mm-hmm. counselors and the employment agency and everything. These are all indirect people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't... You can compare this within the company, but you can't compare it with Lockheed very well.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do. They take a ratio between mm-hmm. the direct and indirect, and we had a favorable ratio.
Now, do these reflect only the main plants, or are the feeders also included
the
in
feeders
these figures?
Are not there.
They're not. Okay, good.
I've got feeder plant stuff someplace.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see if I can find it. Now, I use the term non-recurring here. All that means is in tooling, you build the tooling once for the
mm-hmm.
program, and then all you do is maintain it and keep up with
mm-hmm.
changes. So you get in tooling, you'd get a peak like this, and then it'd fall off.
A plateau.
And the maintenance there. And this here happens to be engineering, which would be non-recurring on any one model. Now, here, annual rates of labor turnover,
mm-hmm.
which is something to look at. Here's to save that. This is, I think, if you read those charts back there, you
right.
get the same numbers.
Right.
But this will give you the number of gross employment at Douglas Long Beach. And the female equivalent
mm-hmm.
of that.
This, I noticed this source, Labor Statistics Airframe Engine and Propeller Plants.
Yeah.
Is that from the California Labor Statistics?
No, that's from Wright Field.
Oh.
Military.
Okay. That's probably hard information to get to, I bet. But it occurs to me that the other companies must also be in that.
They are. No, the figures are available if you
mm-hmm.
can run them down in the archives or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
They have a record.
In the National Archive, you mean? Or just each company?
Well, I would try the companies first,
mm-hmm.
but then I would go through the, if it's an Air Force plant, I'd go through the Air Force, and you might eventually wind up in the
mm-hmm.
National Archives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But every one of them should have this kind of a
mm-hmm.
set up here watching the gals.
Do you recall anything that ever showed the breakdown by the age of the...
Our Douglas charts, the other things were military. Any of that shiny Finnish stuff.
Oh, okay.
Were military. Mm-hmm. So you know, the words, some of it had some words connected with it, I think. And they're definitely the words of the Air Force.
Mm.
See, the Air Force selected the Douglas Long Beach plant for a review.
Oh, I see.
Of the total history of the plant. And that's where that's their language right there. And I knew I had that photograph somewhere.
Oh, this is of the bargaining group. Uh-huh. Now, which is the woman that you had mentioned? Can you tell from her photograph?
Look around this way.
Their hairdo so similar that it's hard to...
Yeah, I know, the one standing up.
Uh-huh.
And this is the president of the union.
Mm-hmm.
Doug Sr., these are all union. This is the plant superintendent myself. We were signing a union contract.
Uh-huh. That was the first...
I thought it had a date on it. That would have been 1946.
Oh.
Just one of the deals.
Do you recall anything? This is very helpful because one of the things that I'm trying to do is assess, as we pick the women that we're going to actually be interviewing, how many should we pick who worked at Douglas Long Beach, how many who worked at Lockheed, how many who worked at Douglas Santa Monica. So this will really help in terms of Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall any information that might still be around or that you have in your head in terms of the distribution, in terms of the jobs themselves, and also about how many... black women and how many Mexican women there might have been in the factory.
We weren't conscious of black or Mexican. Everybody was conscious of women.
Uh-huh.
But the minority picture didn't go any further.
Uh-huh.
And
do you have a sense from your experience, would it have been as high as 10% minority women, do you think?
Minority, including women?
No, among the women themselves, would you say would be as high as 10% of them would be minority?
Well, if you classed Mexican and Oriental and so forth, yeah. I would have the feel, because of the large Mexican influx into it, that it'd easily be 10%. You know.
There were a fair number of Mexican women working.
There always has been, yeah.
Because one of the things that we want to be sure when we start our interviews, that we pick enough minority women so that we are really representing the range of the women who were working during the period. And it's so hard to get that information in terms of what the percentage was.
Yeah. I don't know where you'd get it at any of the Douglas plants. It's the type of thing they'd throw away.
Mm.
Because it has... at the time it was thrown away, and it wouldn't have any value in the minds of the people. Now they're very conscious of it in the last 10 years.
From your recollections, would you say that there were more Mexican women than black women in the fact?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, we, outside of Compton moving down into that area there, black women were certainly not trained to go seek a job, and the black males the same way. Very, I know in engineering, for instance, there were, I would say in World War II, there were two black engineers in the whole engineering department. Men.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was made a group leader. But we were not conscious of that type of thing. We were very conscious of the women, regardless of what they looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And they introduced a problem. In the first place, the lights look bad, particularly if they had blemishes. They never did. As far as I could see, the whole war came out with a cosmetic setup that took care of the women under the mercury vapor lights. They got over some of the real garish-looking ones that when they immediately got in the factory light, and they finally came up with some usable things, but that was always a problem. So you're conscious. See, when the biggest minority group coming in are women, you don't have any breakdowns that blacks or orientals or anything like that either caused or helped the whole problem or were better or not as good or anything like that. There's no consciousness of that, certainly on my part or the people that I recall talking to. And the statistic wouldn't be useful because it was such a small amount.
That's what's so difficult for us, is just determining the proportions, so that when we pick the women we're going to interview, making sure that we have adequate representation, yet those are exactly the figures that you can't get your fingers on.
Yeah, I don't know where you'd get... There's a fellow that did some work on employment and so forth that might be helpful to you, Dr. James Wilburn.
Wilburn?
Yeah, he did his doctorate about 7 or 8 years ago at UCLA, and I think it was something like... the manpower impact on World War II aircraft industry or something like that. He leads up and Wilburn was provost at the Pepperdine LA campus. A very sensible, capable person. Jim was... And having more recently done somewhat like you're doing, he's going backwards in time and trying to reconstruct the picture. He covered, there'd be questions on Lockheed and some of these other companies that he could comment on.
Is he at the Malibu campus now, or is he no longer?
I don't know where he is. I haven't talked to Jim for... 3 or 4 years.
I could try. I'm sure they would know where he is in any event.
Yeah, he was at the LA campus, and he still may be there. So, I don't know if Pepperdine's still...
I think they finally moved everything out to Malibu.
Okay. Well, they would have made a mistake if they didn't move him, because he was a high-caliber guy. And a lot of common sense.
I'll check with that with him, too. He and Donahue sound like they would be very good.
Yeah, they're very good sources. Wilburn, his paper would be in the UCLA library, and I went up and dug it out one time and read it, and was impressed with it.
We should certainly look into that. Now, in terms of the actual distribution on the line, I mean, the image, of course, is all the women were riveting, but what were the, were there certain jobs that the women were concentrated in more than others?
Well, of course, the most prominent job in the factory was so-called drilling and riveting, and there'd be more women there than there would be anyplace else. But there were women scattered throughout that were in engineering.
Did they have engineering degrees, or they were in...
In fact, I think they feature one or two here at... Now, this Christina St. Clair, she is really the woman, the male woman at the factory. She worked for Douglas back in Martin, too.
She is still around?
Yeah. Now, here's Constance Walker, a tool designer, studied mechanical engineering at UCLA. And I know there was... We had another gal in here making one of the pictures. She was Frances Lamar, holds an AV degree from Stanford Engineering and Engineers in engineering. So you see, there would be people that would appear almost any place in the factory. And by the end of the war, there was a handful of gals that could lead a group of people. I can't think of the name, but I can remember some that you were not conscious they were a woman. There was a woman you were talking to.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this one, she was a lead woman, had maybe 8 to 10 males under her. Now, you just, I remember her because you were not conscious that you were dealing with a woman on the job. It just looked like she could handle the job, everybody knew that,
mm-hmm.
and the men worked for her and thought she was mm-hmm. great. Well, that's really rare.
So she had a voice of authority, in effect. That was
respected. She had a manner.
Mm-hmm.
The voice was all right, too, but she had a manner of, let's do it, what mm-hmm. you want, you know, get the job done, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You had a feeling that she was as good as any other male lead man in the whole, and possibly better, and had a very alert. Now, the trouble is, in a big factory, I only see pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if something caused me to talk to this gal mm-hmm. maybe 3 times, maybe 4. But you get these immediate impressions. After you've been through a lot of the problems and mm-hmm. so forth, then when you see a woman that really has a commanding attitude towards the job, and she's running those guys, and she's on her performance curve, you just remember.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember her. Now I'm talking about, she hung on after the war. And this was during the Korean War that
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about.
What proportion of the lead men were women during the war years themselves?
I have no idea.
Yeah, can you think of any place where there would be figures on the job breakdowns of the women themselves?
No. Jim Wilburn
mm-hmm.
may have run on to some statistical pile someplace
mm-hmm.
that there was no need to capture those things. But staring at a book here that I saved, I had the company buy this for me. During the war, Industrial Relations Handbook.
Hmm.
Now, that thing has statistics in it, and they may have preserved some items that they thought were important. I'm sure they did, because that book is really a history of what was going on.
Because we've looked in some of those factory management magazines.
If you wanted to borrow that, mail it back to me.
Oh, thank you. Or I could bring it by the museum in Santa Monica. Oh, thank you so much. Because then we could glance through it.
I use that quite a bit because this was all new to me, too, the training business. And I was interested in industrial relations. You don't work with a problem very long to where you can realize that if it's analyzed properly and the right person put on to correct it, and you don't wave mm-hmm. and shout and demand and push to get it done, there's an easier way to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some tools in that book that are basically the same today. They're a little obsolete because they have such a skimpy base. But There are volumes, of course, now on the same subject.
Now, this will be very helpful because I'm sure it's exactly what each of the plant managers and personnel people were using from the period, so I appreciate that.
And you will find, I think, statistics in there. I didn't bother to run through it, but it might be useful.
Now, it sounds like there are things down at the museum that would be helpful to poke around in, to see what sort of information we can
get. You see, people accidentally use comparisons.
Right.
And they illustrate a point. And this is research, I guess, is usually called, and you find these things if you're sensitive to it.
And there is a library actually set up in the museum now.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, before we quit here, as the planning for demobilization began, what were some of the feelings and thoughts about trying to keep some of the women, and how do you think the women were responding to the notion of their leaving?
You mean at the end of the war?
As the war was drawing to close and as the employment was beginning to go down.
Well, there were those, and it's hard to distinguish between male and female here, the great relief that it's all over. I want to get out of here and get back to whatever their norm was. Have a vacation. There was the fact that they were losing their job, just chopped right off like that, and done in one day. We laid off 13,000 people, and just chopped it off like that. Everybody was happy, see, because their discharge was a reward for having won the war, in effect. It looked that way. So there were very few people grouchy or anything like that, and everybody was helpful. And so to draw any conclusions from VE and VJ Day would be misleading, but there were some women determined to hang on, and believe me, and this is where we got back into from the single now to the multiple skills. They had to do more than just drill that hole. And some of them felt capable of doing this. Some of them were completely ignorant of the fact that there were people that could make the hole part before the war, and that they were just doing one 10% or 30%, depending on how many holes they poked through it, see. And a sudden awareness that opportunity was there, and the union was so set up that they had to be given a chance. Now, you're getting a lot of argument there. The union accuses you of loading up this gal so you can get rid of her by multiplying the operations that you want her to do. Now, why didn't you do that with Joe over here? So, there was a lot of battling back and forth on seniority, believe me. And you got a woman with an A rating with some seniority. It was pretty hard to get rid of her.
But there was an attempt to try, for those who were interested, to try and train or see if some of them were trainable to the more complicated set of operations?
We weren't that mature. And we just didn't think in those terms of... by then, of course, we had training programs going on, and we could go to this JIT and JRT, JMT deal, and if you had done that and done well, undoubtedly there was somebody close to you, that, a teacher or somebody, that would defend your position, that yes, she can do it, and a lot of them can do it with certain amount of instruction on what the new jobs are, and how to perform them. And that comes under the JMT, job methods, job relations, how you handle it, job instruction, how you instruct. So the mechanisms were there, but there are many concepts that are well developed, but the problem hasn't appeared yet, even today. And the same thing then. All these things were there, but we didn't all understand that they were really tools.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about management tools, and nobody ever trained me. I just fell into spots and hung on, see? So I fortunately had on my staff at one time, I had 6 Harvard Business School graduates and from Caltech, they were Caltech mm-hmm. engineers, except one was Warner. And they were the sharpest guys I've ever seen. I learned more over out of 2 of them, particularly, were the brightest people I've ever known, and both heads of their classes. They became personal friends. We'd go out on Saturday night, and we may harangue over some of the problems we're talking about here till 4 in the morning or something like that. And I learned a great deal from these two, particularly the 2 of them. So it broadened my vision of these things as management tools.
Mm-hmm.
I was just an engineer. So I was introduced to other concepts, increased my vocabulary in the management field. And it's tough to see a management problem and not have the words to convey it to somebody else. That's what a lot of people felt.
Mm-hmm.
There were changes going on around you, and you had to keep up with them. And a lot of them didn't. And a lot of these women were willing to keep up with the change, and a lot of them were so happy. They remembered the way it used to be, but
mm-hmm.
it was never going to be that way again. They just didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
They went back to the kitchen, and there was a battle for about 2 years for appliances, which were very scarce
mm-hmm.
on the market and so forth. Suddenly they were buying more things and wanted more income, and they remembered how easy it was in World War II. A lot of them came back and rehired in.
Mm-hmm.
As we grew in the Korean War, we got back into
Went to the smaller job descriptions again?
Whatever was available.
Mm-hmm.
So, by then we had personnel had grown, and it was no longer just an employment agency. They had good interview practices. The interviewers were trained, and some of our people in the shop would go to our people and personnel and train them on what the job is out in the factory, and you take them out there.
Mm-hmm.
Say, now when you interview for these machinists, this is what I'm talking about. And then we'd even give them a little drawing from engineering. It's a little tricky, let's say,
mm-hmm.
on making a small part. And the interviewer would hand them that, and then ask questions about
mm-hmm.
how would you make the part or something like that if it were for a planning
mm-hmm.
job or something like that. So women came back in. You have to recognize the Korean War coming, say, around 1951, and beginning to peak up, and the demand tremendous
mm-hmm.
Restructure the whole plant activity there at Long Beach and elsewhere. These women came back into the act again. Some of them hung on again. And you get that up and down.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, that up and down deal, if you applied the other aircraft company, all aircraft companies in Southern California
mm-hmm.
together, the curve was maybe like this, see? But each one was going like
right.
this. But they happened to phase themselves such that you could be an assembler, riveter here at Douglas, Long Beach, and you're laid off for lack of work, and Lockheed is just growing, see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going through it right now. Boeing has a bunch of people in the city interviewing now. It's
mm-hmm.
on TV and the radio. Garrett and Northrop and Paul. Some of them were bringing back retirees. So every time that happens, you get a bunch of women.
Mm-hmm.
They go right in. They're part of the labor force, and they move in, and it's so structured now that if you can do it, the job's yours, and the pay is equal. And there's no question about that.
Now, of the women who have been, I imagine that there were a fair number who came out of apparel manufacturing, for instance, who came into aircraft because it paid better. Did you find with those women that they were able to do more of the functions, or was it still limited to a very specific function, an assembly, say, or drilling, or
riveting? Well, an airplane, there weren't too many coming from other areas of work other than welders.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, the welder had to pass a test and get a certificate, because aluminum welding was different and aircraft welding was different and so forth. So most workers who were working elsewhere, they were coming in to a different kind of a product, very highly specialized, carefully screened, made up of thousands of parts, and carrying people without visible means of support to the airplane, and it bothered a lot of people, and they took their job seriously. But any training anybody had elsewhere, there was a certain degree of transfer training. I often wondered about it, but obviously it worked to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything else to say on that one.
What about the women?
Don't forget the overriding deal that a lot of these women came in and may have left a better job, but they were in because they had a son or a husband or something that's at war, or we're at war. And I don't have much pride working in Van de Kamp's bakery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a cut in pay and come across and work in an airplane or military of some kind. So you had, I would say that the women were far more, I hate to use the word, patriotic. They were serious about the work. Now part of that was just the first time they'd entered into this kind of work, and they were serious about making mistakes and so forth. But I think they felt more, when a member of the family, and it could be a cousin even, or it could be a neighbor, they were motivated by that more than the male population.
By the sort of personal drive, basically, relating it to an individual.
They wanted to be personally involved to help, because my neighbor down the street is over in the South Pacific, and I want to help him some way. I think that patriotic deal had a lot to do with it, particularly with the women. I came away with that impression, as I recall. Because we used the patriotic theme, we had to constantly remind people that we were at war. Because it was a lot of, the pay was good and the job reasonably secure, and it was a lark to a lot of people. And it again became a great meeting ground for people, too. So,
were there a lot of women in inspection? Was that a fairly high proportion of the department?
No, there were some in inspection.
But it wasn't as high a proportion as
You'd be lucky if it'd be 1%.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The drilling and riveting, the assembly occupations, I think you've always had the feeling that it's a man's job, and maybe I'll make go of it for a while by using a woman in the job. The thought of women is going in primarily into the riveting and drilling and assembly, machine operations and that thing. The first place, they hadn't established themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nothing held a woman with an engineering degree, nothing held her back from being in engineering. The women hadn't qualified themselves, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But if a woman engineer came along, believe me, she'd go into engineering. Now, when she got into engineering, what they put her to doing, while blueprints or what it might have been can be a different story.
Yeah. Are there any women still at Douglas in engineering, for instance, who date back from that period?
Well, I don't know about dating back to that period. I don't know. What I would do is I'd call this fellow Tyler and ask him to isolate someone for you to talk to.
Something that occurred to me before when you mentioned as the war was coming to an end and as production started to decrease, was the plan to go back into less discrete job units, to go back into more specialized work again? Had that always been the intention, that this was just an emergency effort for the war?
Yeah.
I mean, you still view it as being more efficient to not have the very, very small job unit.
Yeah, that is a function of the rate of production and the complication of the thing or the product being designed. If you have a high production rate, it means that the airplane itself is broken into smaller pieces. And you have to be careful. You don't try to hatch an egg faster by putting two hens on it, type of thing. So you supposedly now have hired people, manufacturing engineers, planners, who, as the rate increases, the type of tooling goes from what we call the Detroit type die, automotive Class A die. But the aircraft industry had cheaper ways of making it. So if you only had a contract for 20 airplanes, then almost everything you did was multiple skills in there and using crude tools. Now if you get up to high rate of production, you brought in the Class A type tooling, which you could almost hand to anybody to use. And then we tried to foolproof some of it so you couldn't put the casting in upside down. We had an awful lot of trouble like that. And sometimes it's hard to foolproof something. But towards the end of the war, we were working pretty hard at trying to foolproof.
Because it sounds like it was always viewed as a temporary war measure, both in terms of the discreteness of the job as well as the people who were coming in to do that.
We all expected the women to go back to the house, back to the kids, and what a relief it must be for her now to be able to go back and do that. Only there were some shrewd ones that said, I don't want to go back.
You know, one of the very interesting things is, and what got me going on all of this, was that there was a study done in 1944 by the Women's Bureau, which is part of the Department of Labor. And they interviewed something like 13,000 women in 10 different war-related areas. Southern California was not one of them, but Seattle was one, and I think San Francisco was another. And something like 80% of them who were working in the war-related industry said that they did plan after the war to continue, and that they did prefer to have the kind of job they had, which, of course, was not what happened. That's what got me interested in terms of what really did happen and how do they feel about what had happened to them, to, you know, go to some of them directly and start interviewing them about it.
Yeah. Well, while there may not be some women working at Douglas Long Beach, they will be living in the community.
We've gotten, there was a little teeny item in the IPT last week, and there may have been a story this week or perhaps next week, they came out and interviewed me about the project. And just from this small little item, we've started getting phone calls from people who did work at Douglas Long Beach. So I think the aircraft and the shipyard workers, we won't have that much trouble locating. I think it's going to be considerably more difficult for us to locate people who work in electrical, steel, and rubber. That's going to be more difficult.
Yeah, of course, those companies were supposedly more advanced in the, all the methods work and personnel relations. Mm-hmm. My gosh, you take Western Electric, they were doing big work in that field in the 20s, early 20s.
Right, all those time studies.
So that showed some of the old standard product outfits, like electrical and so forth. If you get into the big ones, I think they were influenced a lot by Western Electric pioneering work. The third big crowd, Gilbreth, cheaper by the dozen. He did a lot of work.
Yeah, our problem, I think, is going to be finding the women who worked in those places, because when you talk about something that's, even if you use the word defense plant, they don't think of those other kinds of industries that were really involved, too, and that were classified as defense plants. So this has been very, very helpful, and these tables are going to be very helpful in terms of our determining who to pick. And I think what we'll need to do is, because the